Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now Slate Magazine columnist Fred Kaplan on his piece that argues Edward Snowden won't and shouldn't get clemency, and on the news the last few days that al-Qaeda-linked forces have taken Fallujah in Anbar province in Iraq, the same place where 1,500 Americans died in that war a decade ago. Fred Kaplan writes the War Stories column for Slate and is author of the book The Insurgents, David Petraeus and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. Hi, Fred. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, thanks.
Let's talk about Iraq first. We usually think of al-Qaeda as loosely knit terrorists carrying out attack on civilians here and there. Is this really al-Qaeda as some kind of coherent military or governing force seizing a section of Iraq?
I get the impression that this is the same organization that was called al-Qaeda in Iraq during the war, which is indeed a coherent organization. But whether or not it is, or whether it's that, or whether it's something a bit looser, it's important to understand what's going on here. This has nothing to do with the fact that the United States left Iraq. This has everything to do with the fact that Prime Minister Maliki backpedaled on his pledges to be more inclusive about bringing in Sunnis to the government, to the military, to the police, to the various ministries. You might recall that the Fallujah and Ramadi, the places where the al-Qaeda or whoever they are is returning, this is the site of what was once called the Anbar Awakening. That was when, you know, Sunni tribesmen were getting impatient with al-Qaeda, which was dominating them, and they let U.S. forces come in and collaborated with the U.S. forces to kick al-Qaeda out.
This is like now, 2004, right?
2006 and 7. It was
okay.
The beginning of the surge.
Right.
It kind of antedated the surge by just a little bit. Why did al-Qaeda come in there in the first place? Because the Sunnis felt insecure about Maliki's Shiite government. They feared what they called ethnic cleansing, which actually was going on by the Shiite government. We came in, helped them form a cohesive force, created, it was almost like a community organizing kind of thing, but with weapons. And then also David Petraeus, who became the commander of all U.S. forces in Iraq, also started going after Shiite extremist groups, for example, the ones in Sadr City, leaving the Sunnis to think, oh, well, maybe this is going to be a balanced government after all. And the whole point of the surge and all those extra U.S. troops that came in, and many of whom got killed, the whole point was to give the Iraqi political factions some breathing space, so that they could get their act together without having to worry about bombs going off all over the place. And then remember why we left. U.S. forces left because there was a status of forces agreement signed by the Iraqi government and the Bush administration in the final months of 2008, saying that in exchange for letting U.S. forces stay for another few years, all U.S. forces had to be out of Iraq, air, land, sea, everything, by the end of 2011. This was not an Obama decision. This was signed by the Bush administration. And they did it because the Iraqis didn't want us to be there. The SOFA agreement could have been revised, but only if the Iraqi parliament allowed for a revision, and they were in no mood or even any coherence to do that. So we did not get out because of Obama. We got out because of something that the Iraqis wanted us to do.
Didn't the Bush administration want to keep some U.S. forces in Iraq, but
yeah,
he couldn't
did,
win approval from the Iraqi government to exempt any Americans there from prosecution under Iraqi law for any crimes they may potentially have committed?
Well, you know, that is a clause in every status of forces agreement that the United States military has with countries worldwide. That's sort of a red line. I know that many people have said, oh, we should have been able to make a deal. Well, if you don't have a deal about that, then you don't have a deal about keeping U.S. forces, and that goes anywhere. I'm kind of, you know, this has been going on for a long time now. Every once in a while, it just annoys the hell out of me. People like John McCain, who know better, and people who don't know better, say, you know, that, oh, Obama abandoned Iraq. You know, it's not the case at all. And
it
I know for a fact that there were several top Obama officials who had also worked in the Bush administration who did go to Iraq and tried to work out some kind of deal that would allow some forces to be left there. And the Iraqis were the ones who refused any kind of compromise.
And I think even a further back reality check is called for here as people talk about this being the result of the U.S. pulling out, whether it was Bush's fault or Obama's fault. There was no al-Qaeda in Iraq until President Bush's war.
That's right. That's another point. And,
to defend Saddam Hussein's brutal regime, but the U.S. invasion created the chaos that allowed al-Qaeda to come into Iraq when Saddam, for his own purposes, was keeping them at bay. The war started the al-Qaeda presence in Iraq. The war caused the al-Qaeda presence in Iraq. That was not there before.
No, that's absolutely true. And then there was the decision made very soon after the invasion. And it's amazing that, you know, a dozen years after the fact, we still don't know where this decision came from, who wrote this decision. But it was the two orders that Paul Bremer issued when he first became proconsul in Iraq, you know, dismantling the Iraqi army.
That's Bush administration, top guy in Iraq at first, Paul Bremer.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I should have. Yeah, dismantling the U.S. Army and making it illegal for anyone in the Sunni party, I mean in the Ba'athist party, to hold any government position. That, if the invasion didn't do enough, that created utter anarchy. And then when the Maliki administration, after elections, did not let Sunnis into his government and into his military, that created, look, things like al-Qaeda come into power vacuums, or call them what you will, only because of disenchanted public that needs their support. If the public hadn't been disenchanted, they wouldn't have had any openings to go into. And in fact, one of the great triumphs, although a short-term one, of the 06-07 surge was this, you know, Anbar Awakening and the Sons of Iraq movement that let the Sunnis feel like they were about to become a part of the country. And after we left, Maliki tore that apart. He started going after Sunni political leaders. He arrested his own vice president, who was a Sunni. He gave the Sunnis the impression that we are not being allowed into our country. This government is not ours. And then al-Qaeda comes in and exploits these tensions. There's a story in the New York Times today which quotes a lot of people in Anbar province saying that they prefer to have al-Qaeda, much as they hate them, than to ally themselves with the current government.
Wow. And this is so sad. I think it's so important
it's
to say.
Tragic.
For the people, many of the people of that area, and for the many thousands of American troops who fought and the loved ones of those who died there, if the numbers that I've been reading are right, 1,500 of the 4,500 American deaths in Iraq were in this Fallujah Anbar province area. And the media is full of Iraq war vets re-asking the question today, did their colleagues die in vain? For example, here is Will Walsh, a former Army captain who fought in Fallujah during the war, on All Things Considered yesterday.
The question I have to ask myself is was that effort in vain? You know, was all of the work that we did, all the sacrifice that we had, what is the benefit?
And a partial answer to him in that report from Cale Weston, who was embedded with the Marines in Fallujah for the State Department.
A lot of Americans want to forget about it, but there are thousands and thousands who don't have the luxury of forgetting about it. I don't think it was all in vain, but in the big picture, the American legacy there is now being subsumed by more violence.
So a couple of the Americans who were there at the time, and Fred Kaplan, War Stories columnist for Slate and author of the book about David Petraeus called The Insurgents, that it just makes me sick at heart to think of the cost of the Iraq war as it goes ever higher. 100,000 or hundreds of thousands of dead Iraqis, depending on whose numbers you believe, those 4,500 dead Americans, the rise of al-Qaeda now and other factionalism, all for no WMDs, and little or no additional U.S. national security post 9/11, one could argue, and the Arab Spring might have toppled Saddam Hussein with much less loss of life. Just so many people killed.
Yeah, the Iraq War is going to be looked back upon. The invasion of Iraq is going to be looked. Well, it's already being looked at. So, as one of the great strategic miscalculations in all of American history, I think. You know, there was a certain stability in the Middle East, and I know you had people like Condoleezza Rice saying, well, stability isn't important, we need to push democracy, and now we have neither stability nor democracy. The power structure that was upended by the Iraq invasion strengthened Iran. It diverted resources from Afghanistan and allowed that situation, which had been fairly stable after, you know, the invasion of Afghanistan at the end of 2001, early 2002. That fell apart because we took our eye off of it. The entire Middle East is now engulfed in various proxy wars of Sunni and Shia powers. Every conflict is now being subsumed in some category of a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. None of this would have happened. Now, some other things might not have happened either, but none of this, which is what's worrying everybody, would have happened had the United States not invaded Iran, Iraq.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about Edward Snowden. Mm-hmm. This, folks, is why we originally invited Fred on the show today, and then this Iraq stuff was breaking, and I really felt compelled to raise it with him, Fred being really such an expert on Iraq and David Petraeus and the insurgency. So let's talk, however, about Edward Snowden. On ABC this week on Sunday, there were Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer of New York and Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul taking positions that might seem counterintuitive based on their party affiliations. Rand Paul first.
I don't think we can selectively apply the law. So James Clapper did break the law, and there is a prison sentence for that. So did Edward Snowden. I don't think Edward Snowden deserves a death penalty or life in prison. I think that's inappropriate, and I think that's why he fled, is that's what he faced. Do I think that it's okay to leak secrets and give up national secrets and things that could endanger lives? I don't think that's okay either. But I think the courts are now saying that what he revealed was something the government was doing was illegal. So I think personally he probably would come home for some penalty of a few years in prison, which would be probably not unlike what James Clapper probably deserves for lying to Congress, and that maybe if they served in a prison cell together, we'd become further enlightened as a country over what we should and shouldn't do.
Rand Paul incredibly equating the crimes of Snowden and the director of U.S. intelligence, James Clapper, and suggesting that perhaps they should serve in a prison cell together. Chuck Schumer, not so much.
Snowden says that he's in the grand tradition of civil disobedience in this country. It is a grand tradition. Part of that tradition is you pay the consequences. If you break the law because your conscience says you have to, you stand trial. That's what, or and pay the consequences. That's what Martin Luther King did, Mahatma Gandhi over in India. The most on-point case is Daniel Ellsberg. So what Snowden ought to do is come back and stand trial and face the consequences, and he'll have his ample opportunity to say why he did what he did and all of that.
Chuck Schumer, preceded by Rand Paul on ABC This Week with George Stephanopoulos on Sunday, and Fred Kaplan from Slate. You wrote a piece that's getting passed around a lot in your War Stories column, and you're more in Schumer's camp, aren't you?
Well, I think there's a lot to unpack here. My main point, and I think the main point, that all sides are overlooking. My view is this. If all that Edward Snowden had done was to unleash documents showing that the extent of NSA domestic surveillance goes way beyond what anybody had imagined, goes beyond what the non-secret portion of the Patriot Act allowed, goes beyond, in some instances, what even the FISA court had permitted, then I think there would be something to talk about here in terms of if not clemency, then at least a dramatically reduced sentence over what the law literally calls for. However, that's not all that Snowden released. Snowden released, I've been told by one person, tens of thousands of documents. Somebody told me 1.1 million documents. The leaks that have been appearing in The Guardian and The Washington Post are about documents showing, talking about the NSA's interception of email traffic, mobile phone calls, and radio transmissions of Taliban fighters on Pakistan's Northwest Territories, about an operation to gauge the loyalties of CIA recruits in Pakistan, about CIA NSA email intercepts in Iran. In his first interview with the South China Morning Post when he was in Hong Kong, Snowden revealed that the NSA hacks into hundreds of computers in China and Hong Kong. This is not whistleblowing. This is not alerting the American people to something improper that is being done in their name. These are operations that I expect most Americans suppose the NSA is involved in. They involve foreign operations against foreign targets. You might not like the war in Afghanistan, and as you know, Brian, I've been very critical of the war.
Right.
We might not like certain policies that the United States is engaged in abroad, but the NSA, in a lot of these documents, is shown to be assisting U.S. policy in these efforts in an unequivocally legitimate way. And so what my point is that he has revealed a lot of state secrets that have nothing to do with domestic surveillance and even nothing to do with spying on allies. And then, to top it off, what does he do? It's not that he just flees. He flees first to Hong Kong, which is essentially a Chinese protectorate, and then to Russia. Now, this isn't the Cold War. These aren't our ideological foes anymore. But Russia and China are basically our main adversaries in the realm of cyber warfare, cybersecurity, call it what you will. There is also a report in the Russian press and in the newspaper Kommersant that the 3 days that Snowden disappeared in Hong Kong after he left the hotel where he was interviewed by Greg Greenwald, that he was in the Russian consulate. So if we are going to do some plea bargaining with Snowden, I think some questions need to be answered. Is it true that he went to the Russian consulate? He told James Risen of the New York Times that he didn't take any classified material with him into Russia. Well, did he give it to the Russians in the consulate? Did he talk with Chinese? What did he talk to the
Russians
about?
You have no evidence that he did, though.
I have no evidence. But look, this is Daniel Ellsberg, to cite the gold standard of this sort of thing. He released the Pentagon Papers, which were historical documents about how the United States got into Vietnam and the lies that it told once it was there. He did not reveal ongoing tactical military operations. In fact, he withheld several volumes of the papers dealing with ongoing peace negotiations. He then did not go to Hanoi to criticize the war and tout the Hanoi and tout Ho Chi Minh. You know, Snowden went to Moscow and gave a press conference where he thanked the Putin government for its support of human rights. I mean, you know, there are some very suspicious things about this, and whether or not you suspect anything larger, my point is that this is not whistleblowing as we understand it.
Or not all of it was, and
right.
I get that as your main point. But are there any consequences of these other things that he did? I'm thinking of the hysteria, and tell me if you agree that it was largely hysteria, over the WikiLeaks State Department document dump. People wrung their hands so much about how we can never do diplomacy anymore because mm-hmm. other countries know what the Secretary of State really thinks about them
right.
and all of this. Even though a lot of it showed the U.S. diplomacy in a very positive light.
Yeah, I wrote that.
So did that ever really happen? And are there any real national security consequences to Snowden's leaks or just outrage around the world at American arrogance and overreach in addition to what he revealed about the domestic spying?
Well, you know, I've heard varying things about this. I've asked people who are presumably in the know whether they are detecting people, for example, in Pakistan or elsewhere, doing things differently after these leaks. Some people have said yes. Some people have said no. Some people aren't quite sure. The consequences aren't spelled out. But you know, here's the thing. The NSA, I mean, this is like crown jewel stuff of the intelligence community. And I'm not saying that everything that's classified should be classified. I've been very critical of over-classification. But the stuff that's classified at the NSA is at the top of the heap. You know, this guy leaked, you know, stole tens of thousands, perhaps as many as a million, highly, highly, highly classified documents. Here you've got tens of thousands of employees sitting there doing highly classified work. They're told, this is really the, as secret as it gets. You can't tell anybody about any of this stuff. And as again, much of it has to do with things that have nothing to do with domestic surveillance. This guy, not only that, but there is a report in Reuters by two reporters who have been very critical of the NSA and its foreign counterparts, reporting that Snowden got into these documents by asking 20 or 25 of his coworkers, listen, can you give me your logins and passwords because I need them to do some of the work I'm doing as systems administrator. He used that to gain access to a lot of these.
That is documents. Really interesting, and I hadn't seen that until I read it in your article pertaining to this Reuters article, that Snowden snowed many of his colleagues at Booz Allen Hamilton to get
right.
access to classify. Oh, was it or was it
well,
somewhere
he was
else?
A Booz Allen contractor at an NSA facility
right.
in Hawaii.
I see. So he was asking NSA colleagues.
So and they got canned
for their passwords.
Yep.
And
now it was irresponsible for them to give them up, but still. So here's the thing: you can't no
under false premises. It wasn't that they were conspiring with him. He
no,
tricked
not
them.
Not at all. They were unwitting co-conspirators, so to speak. So you have this guy who's done all of this, and then he skedaddles, not to go like directly to Ecuador or something, but to go to Hong Kong, and then from there, supposedly to Ecuador through Moscow, though that's a very interesting route geographically.
Well, he got stuck, right?
Well, but why did he go through Moscow to begin with?
Because it was the only place that would have him, wasn't it?
A deal was, I mean, I don't buy it. If Moscow, the U.S. took away his passport so he couldn't get on a plane. Believe me, if the Russians had wanted him to get on the plane, they could have issued him a temporary visa, which would have allowed him in the transit area, and he could have been on his way. But, you know, you can't, unless you believe that there should be no secrets and there should be no intelligence agencies, and I guess, you know, that's a legitimate position if you want to take it. But unless you believe that, if you have this kind of situation where this guy, you know, steals tens of thousands of documents in the way he did, then leaves the country, goes to our leading adversary when it comes to this realm, for him to say, you know, come on back, you know, some of the things you did were good, so we'll let you off with a few years of a suspended sentence or
not
something.
Not that simple.
You're not... What kind of discipline are you going to have in the race? You know, when you're arresting people for making one phone call to a reporter at the Washington Post, how are you going to let this guy who's undertaken the most massive leak of incredibly highly classified information in American history? How can you say, well, okay, yeah, we'll let you off because roughly half of the things that you leaked. Uncovered something that was good to uncover.
And so the headline of Fred Kaplan's article on Slate is both a prediction and an opinion why Edward Snowden won't and shouldn't get clemency. You can see that on Slate.com, or you might get it in your, you know, in your Twitter feed. A lot of people have been passing it around, and Fred is also the author of The Insurgents, David Petraeus, and The Plot to Change the American Way of War. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, who cares who the New York City Council Speaker is? We'll tell you why you should care, whether it's Dan Gorodnik or Melissa Mark Viverito, that election taking place today. Stay with us.